Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Martine C. from Schwanksville, PA.
Hi, my name's Martine. I'm an alcoholic. My home group, as Lauren said, is Schwanksville Wednesday night, basic AA, 8 p.m. All are welcome. My sobriety date is April 4th, 2000. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for having me tonight. There is a lot more people here standing when I'm here. There's more people out there than there is when I'm in the audience, so bear with me if I'm a little nervous. I will start off by saying, it's a famous quote of my father's from the time that I was little that he always said to us, "I do believe that this disease is hereditary." And from as far back as I can remember, that was something that stuck out in my mind. I come from a long line of alcoholics, especially on my father's side. His parents, his siblings, all dead from alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic. My brother's an alcoholic. He's been up here a few times. And I joked with him on my way up here that you guys are going to be very disappointed that my story is not as exciting as his. I grew up fairly normally. I was the youngest of five kids. I had three older sisters and an older brother. And, my parents did a great job. They sent all five of us through 12 years of Catholic school. We had all of our needs met and most of our wants, and I grew up in a sober home. My dad had gotten sober when I was 5 months old, and I never saw booze. We didn't drink at home. We didn't have parties that involved alcohol. We had a party at the house. There was no booze. That was just understood. So I didn't know about drinking. I didn't know, what it was like to get drunk. It was not a learned behavior for me. Growing up as far back as I can remember, I was an alcoholic. I did not learn that until I came into this program and learned about my disease. I had that thing, that stigma. From the time I was 3 or 4 years old, I don't know if it was the dynamics of my family being the youngest and always feeling that I didn't belong or that I didn't fit in or I was too young to know what was going on. They babied me and hid things from me, which, is what I guess they were supposed to do. But, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. In my family, I wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't athletic enough. My grades weren't good enough. With my friends, I always felt like I didn't belong. And I didn't know why. I knew it wasn't normal. But that was just part of who I was growing up. And, my family, the five of us, were a little notorious for putting fun in dysfunction. And we, mostly the girls, the four of us girls, were pretty wild and loved to carry on and have a good time. And we didn't see anything wrong with that. We still to this day have a great relationship. We did have a great relationship growing up, too. We had our moments. But, I had a great upbringing. I can't complain. I can't blame my alcoholism on anyone. It's just the way I was. And, sitting around the kitchen table, we would have after dinner, at 10 years old, my sisters were older than me, probably 16, 18, and 20. And at that point, we're partying and loving every second of it. And, they would talk about their stories and the parties they were at. And I remember saying to one of my older sisters, she was talking about a buzz. And I said, "What's a buzz?" And she said, it's the greatest thing ever. She said, a couple glasses of wine, you feel warm and fuzzy, and everything's funny, and everyone's your best friend. And it was so romantic to me, the way that she just told this story about the buzz. And I said, I can't wait to get a buzz. And she introduced not only me, but my older brother to our first drink. I was 12 and he was 14. And my parents were away, and she and my cousin were babysitting. And they were practicing doing shots at the kitchen table, and they were struggling. And my brother and I decided that we were going to show them how to do shots. And this was our first time drinking. And so we did, you know, so be it. He and I are the two that are in the program. We showed them how to do shots. And they sent us to bed. I didn't get drunk. As far as I know, I went right to bed. I got up and went to school the next day. And that was it for me. That feeling of they let me do a big kid thing, you know. I felt like I arrived. And that was my ticket into fitting in wherever I needed to go. It was still another 2 years until I actually had my first drunk. I was in high school and, you know, started hanging. And my brother was a senior and I was a freshman, so I was hanging out with some older kids and he was throwing parties and, you know, I participated. And, you know, it was at every weekend somebody's parents were away. It just so happened that somebody knew somebody who was having a party, and it was Monday morning at school. You spent the whole week trying to figure out who was having the party on Friday night, and that's what we did. We drank. The first time I got drunk, I drank to excess. I had the spins. I threw up all over myself, and when I got up to the next day, everybody was talking about it, and I was thrilled. I could not wait to do that again. I was fun. I could talk to anybody. You know, the magic stuff it did for everybody else in here. Why did we drink? You know, it made me somebody that I didn't, that I never was. It made me somebody that I wanted to be, but couldn't be by myself. And that went on 4 years of weekend warrior, you know. My biggest claim to fame is I have a lot of I nevers. I never got a DUI. I never got in trouble with the law. I never got an underage drinking. I never got busted. Nothing. No legal issues. I just went on and drank, and that was my reasoning for not having a problem, you know. By the time I was a senior in high school, things started to go a little funny. Booze wasn't my friend anymore. I started becoming angry. I became a pretty angry drunk. I wasn't fun anymore. I wasn't funny. I wasn't everybody's best friend. I couldn't catch that buzz anymore. I just went straight to shit-faced. And I was very famous for drunk dialing at 2 a.m. I would call you up and tell you exactly what I thought about you and then wonder why you didn't talk to me the next day. I was very slowly starting to lose people in my life that I cared about because of alcohol. And, you know, I started to notice some of my friends were, you know, spending the weekend doing essays and filling out college applications. And forget that, man. There was a party to go to, you know. And I spent my senior year pretty much doing that. And I came to the conclusion that the best thing for me to do was to just work at the diner and party at everybody else's college on the weekends. So that way I didn't need to pick one college. I could just go to each of them every weekend. And that is, in a nutshell, what I did. 18, 19 years old, each weekend I ruined myself. I took myself a little bit deeper into that spiral. And you know, things started getting pretty ugly, you know, where people started saying to me, you know what, don't come back next weekend. You know, we don't want you here next weekend. And I found myself trying to find other people to drink with and other crowds that would let this fun drunk in, you know, only I wasn't fun anymore. And, you know, I started noticing things about myself, you know, not just the anger issues and a lot of the stuff that I was doing. I noticed how I was starting to feel differently from other people. You know, I'd be at a party and it would be, you know, they'd have a keg party and somebody would yell the keg was kicked and I would start sweating. And, you know, they would say to me, what is your problem? You are trashed, but there's no more beer. You know, I would do whatever I needed to do to find some more beer until I was completely passed out. I couldn't just give it up. I had a problem with there not being any beer left, you know. And they all thought there was something wrong with that. I didn't see what the problem was. I started noticing I was different, you know. So started wondering, you know, if maybe I might have that hereditary thing that my dad always talked about. He always used to throw slogans around, you know, turn it over and this too shall pass. And we'd be like, shut up. And, you know, at 19 years old, I found myself pregnant and alone and relieved because I had a small feeling in the back of my mind that this child was going to fix me. At that point, I knew I was going nowhere fast. And, you know, I also knew that there would be a nine-month period where I wouldn't be able to drink. And only alcoholics drink when they're pregnant also is what I told myself. So I didn't drink while I was pregnant, so I couldn't be an alcoholic. And boy, did that alcoholism really take off because I couldn't drink. And I was angry and I was miserable. And I could not wait to have this baby so that I could start drinking. I was going to start from scratch and start drinking like a normal person. And I had that baby, and 6 days later, I was at the first kegger I could find. She was 6 days old. She was at home with my mother, and my sister had to come pick me up at a party. And I was mad, you know, that I had to go home and take care of this baby. I was 19 years old. I was supposed to be drinking, not taking care of a baby. You know, and there went my life. You know, I thought she was going to fix me. And it made things very bad. It made things a lot worse. I lived at home with my parents, she and I. And, you know, from 20 to 21, you know, I couldn't wait for that 21st birthday because I figured once I turn 21, I can start going to the bars and then it'll get old. You know, I'll grow up a little bit. I'll be a responsible 21-year-old. And it won't be as exciting anymore. I had all these justifications in my head on when I was going to grow up and stop being an alcoholic, you know. And that never happened. At 21 years old, she was a year. And I had gotten to the point where I was drinking every night. I had gotten a job working as a dental assistant because I always talked about, you know, on the bar stool, that I was going to become a dental hygienist. That was my thing that I was going to do. And so I got a job as a dental assistant, and at this point I was drinking every night. And I would go to the bar around 10 o'clock. I would leave the baby at home with my mother, and I would go to the bar around 10, and I would drink until probably 6 because I had gotten to know the bartenders. So after the bar closed, we would stay and play cards and continue to drink. So 6 o'clock in the morning, I would drive home. I would take a nap for an hour, get up, and think that I was actually going to be sober to go to work. And, you know, I would go to work still drunk and be passing out over patients with drills in their mouths. And people, you know, are afraid to go to the dentist. It's probably because people like me. And my boss would look at me with the most horrible look of disgust. And this happened every day, every day. And I would say to myself, I am never doing this again. What is your problem? You know, and I'm talking to myself all morning about how I'm never doing it again. I'm sick as a dog. I can't keep my eyes open. I'm making a fool of myself. Absolutely zero respect for myself. I'm ready to lose my job. I am never doing this again. And by 4 o'clock, I'm trying to figure out what lie I'm going to tell my mother so that I can leave the house. And I would come home from work, and I would get all dressed, and I would say, I'm going to Wawa to get a pack of cigarettes, and I wouldn't come home for 3 days. There were many days a month that my mother would have to call out of work because I wasn't home to take care of my child. And I didn't think that my alcoholism was affecting anyone else. That made for a pretty ugly relationship between she and I. And at this point, my father just wouldn't even talk to me. I think they only let me live there because of the baby. It went like that every night, you know, every night. And I swore the next day that I wasn't going to do it. And, you know, the days that I was home with my daughter, I would get up with her and pretend that everything was okay until everybody left the house. I would put her in front of the TV with Barney, and I would lay on the couch for the better part of 6 to 8 hours. No food, no diaper change, just rewinding Barney. I was a terrible mother. I mean, I can say that today. For the first 2 years of that child's life, I was a terrible mother. They should have taken her from me. You know, one of the things I used to do, this is in my sick alcoholic mind, at Christmas time I would go to the video store and find the Barney tape with the longest running time so that I didn't have to rewind it as many times during the day. She wouldn't bug me if Barney was on. I hate Barney today, mind you. My second child has never seen an episode of Barney. Those behaviors, those alcoholic behaviors are what made me want to drink more. I had gotten to the point in my drinking career that I hated no one more than I hated myself for doing the things that I had done. I drank to get away from myself, and I was the only person I couldn't get away from, you know, and that's what kept me going. I couldn't look at myself. I couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I couldn't take care of myself, let alone this other child. It had gotten to the point where I used to pray that I wouldn't get up in the morning. You know, I was too much of a coward to take my own life, but I didn't want to live. And you know, in the back of my mind, I knew what my problem was, and I was hoping it would kind of resolve itself, and it just wasn't resolving itself, you know. I had gotten pulled over, I lost count at 11. I had gotten pulled over 11 times. You know, cops, no offense if there's cops in the rooms, but sometimes they're so dumb. 2:30 in the morning, I'm parked in the middle of an intersection, and you ask me what I'm doing. Drinking, you know. I never once got asked if I had anything to drink that night. And I know that because it was so painfully obvious that I was drunk that if they asked me, I knew I couldn't lie. You know, I was afraid that I would get in more trouble if I lied. And I would see the lights flashing in my rearview mirrors. They're pulling me over, and I'm going, shit, he is going to make me want go to one of those AA meetings. Talking about my dad, I knew that if I got a DUI, he was going to make me go to a meeting. And he used to try to trick us. Probably 12 years ago, I'll say, he used to run this holiday dinner in December, and he said to all five of us. He said, I need your help selling tickets for this AA dinner. And you're all coming, and you're going to sell tickets, and you get a free dinner out of it. And we were like, all right. You know, so we go, and there are no tickets. The tickets were already sold. And in order to get your free dinner, you had to sit through an AA meeting. So the funny thing about that is, what do they say about that seed being planted? And it was December of 1999, I accidentally was tricked into sitting into my first AA meeting. And the one thing that I can tell you about that is I heard so many people talk about how I felt. And I thought, okay, maybe someday I'll land here, but it ain't tonight because I got a date at the bar. And I went to the bar, and I drank for 4 more months. And you know, I honestly cannot tell you that fateful night what happened, that I had that moment of clarity. It was a Monday night. My parents were on vacation, and I had conned my sister into coming over and staying for the week so that I had a live-in sitter. And I went out on Monday night, and I sat at the bar like I always did. And I was only going to have one. And I desperately, desperately wanted to be one of those people that only had one and could get up and leave. I envied those people that could have one beer and get up and go home. And I could never do that. And believe me, I tried every night. And it never happened. So I sat and I drank my, I don't know how many beers, and I didn't have any money to pay my bill. And you know, the bartender always, I owe that guy a lot of money if I ever run into him again, but he always paid my bill. And I got in my car, and shouldn't have been driving, but I got in my car and I started my short trek home from the Trap Tavern. And, you know, I was blurry. Everything was blurry. And I don't know if it was because I was drunk or because here I was bawling my eyes out. And I didn't really know why. And I just had that moment where all of a sudden everything was clear. I knew where to go. I knew what to do. And I was sick and tired of living, you know. But I was afraid to die. So in that car on the way home, I out loud said, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. And I thought, where the hell did that come from? And I drove home and I walked inside and I had two choices. I could either walk down into the basement or I could walk up and go to bed and wake up tomorrow morning and pretend it didn't happen. I chose to walk down into the basement where my dad's office is and he keeps his Rolodex. And like I said, at this point, my dad had been sober 22 years, and everyone that ever walked into my house that was a friend of his was in the program. I had many, many, many phone numbers to choose from, and I picked the one that didn't have a wife or children because I didn't want to wake anybody up. And at 2:30, I dialed that phone number, and he answered. And it was a guy that my dad was sponsoring. And I just said to him, I need help. And he said, what are you talking about? He thought my parents died on their trip or whatever. And I said, I need help. I have an alcohol problem. And he talked to me till 6 o'clock in the morning until it was time for me to get in the shower and go to work. I don't know what he said. All he said to me at the end of that conversation is, be ready when you're done work tonight because we're going out. And I went all day at work, and you know, from the second I hung up that phone, that desire to go out that night was gone. I finally felt like there was hope, like I was going to give it a shot, and this was it. This was the last resort for me. You know, I had to do something, and if it worked for him and it worked for them, you know, why not give it a shot? So, he did exactly what he said. He picked me up after work. We went and got pizza. We went to the first meeting. It was a Tuesday night, April 4th, and I don't remember anything that they said. I just remember thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to walk into this meeting, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't, it's an anonymous program, and my dad will never find out. And when I walked in, 10 of his friends turned around and looked right at me and said, we've been waiting for you. And before I left that meeting, his other buddy, Billy, said to me, I will pick you up tomorrow. Be ready right after work. And I said, okay. And he did. He picked me up, and we went out. And before the end of that meeting, Tim, his other buddy, said to me, be ready tomorrow. I'm picking you up after work. And I said, okay. And then they said, tomorrow you're going to Collegeville Friday night, and you're going to meet your sponsor, and her name is Jackie. And I said, okay. And I went to Collegeville, and I walked up to this woman named Jackie, and I said, they tell me you're my sponsor. And, boys, they didn't know what they were doing picking her. Because she did not smile, and she did not hug me, and she did not, she's not nice. And that was exactly what I needed, because if you would have hugged me and told me you loved me, I would have ran the other way because I wasn't ready for it. You know, the one thing they told me when I walked in that first night is you don't have to do this anymore. And I thought, I don't. I felt that I needed to do that. I had to do it. I didn't want to drink every night. I didn't want to do the things I did to my parents or my daughter or my friends. I had to. And when they told me I didn't have to do that anymore, what a revelation, you know? And they took care of me. Those guys that my father sponsored were the ones that took care of me the first 4 days in this program. And I didn't want to drink. You know, for the first time in my life, I did not want to drink. And I haven't had an honest desire to drink since that day. You know, which is a blessing because there are some people that struggle. I've been very fortunate that I have no desire to drink today. And, you know, she told me, Jackie, at that first meeting that I met her, she said, I'm not going to suggest anything to you. I'm going to tell you. You're going to call me every day, and you're going to go to a meeting every day because you drank every day, and you're going to work the steps. You're going to read step one every night until I tell you it's time to read step two. And I did. I was scared. I was scared of her. I was scared to drink. And you know what? If anything, it put me to bed at night. You know, I went home and I read that step one, and every time I read it, I saw something else that I didn't see the first time I read it. And, you know, I knew I was an alcoholic. I didn't have an issue with that. I knew I had an alcohol problem. And, you know, the funniest part about this story, there is a God, there is no coincidence in this program. My parents came home from that vacation, and my dad was walking up. I waited till midnight till they got home because I knew I needed to tell my dad that I was in the program because I knew the meeting on Sunday morning he was going to, and so was I. And I figured I better tell him before he got up. So he's walking up the steps, and he looks at me, and he's disgusted look on his face, and he walked right past me. And I thought, all right, well, let me tell Mom first, you know. So I went down, and I said to my mom, I sat there, I said, I need to tell you something. And she said, you're pregnant. I said, no. She said, you got another tattoo. I said, no. And she said, what? And I said, I joined Dad's club. And she said, the golf club? And I said, no. I said, no, I joined that AA thing. And she said, oh, my God, do you think you have a problem? I said, are you kidding me? Do you think I have a problem? And she started crying. She said, let's go tell your dad. And I was scared. Oh, God, I thought he was going to yell at me. And we walked up the steps, and he's sitting in bed, and he's thinking the same thing. She's pregnant. She got another tattoo. Something happened. And she said, she needs to tell you something. And I said, you know, Dad, I've been going to AA. And he just, his eyes got all big, and he looked at me, and he said, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, what happened? And I said, I called Doug. And he just went, he just nodded, you know, like we do now when we know, we nod. And he said, when did you go? I said, Tuesday was my first meeting. And he said, Tuesday the 4th? And I said, yeah. And he said, that was my 22nd anniversary. And I said, shit, I thought it was in May. He said, no, May is my birthday. So my father and I share the same anniversary day. No coincidence. And, you know, from that day forward, the people in this program taught me, carried me. I mean, I didn't know anything coming in. I still don't know anything now, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, coming in, I was scared to death. And, you know, that woman, God bless her, was amazing for me. The one thing she used to say to me is, you're my best sponsee. And I would say, why? And she'd say, because you're willing. She said, you asked for that willingness when you walked in here. And I did. You know, when I walked into the program, I was done. I put my hands up and I said, I don't know what to do anymore. Please tell me what to do and I will do it. I just don't want to feel that pain anymore. That pain of not being able to look at myself, not being able to look at my kid. I just don't want to do it anymore. And I had to follow direction. As much as I hate following direction, I mean, that's what I had to do. And I did everything they told me. If I needed to stand on my head, I did it. You know, and you know, we went through step one, and we went through step two, which I thought step two was going to be a piece of cake because I went to Catholic school. I was up for a rude one on that. You know, I could probably say a mass, but I couldn't tell you anything about God. You know, I was scared to death of God, and I figured I was just going to hell for all the stuff that I did, you know. And the one thing that Jackie used to say to me was, if you eat meat on Friday, do you think you're going to hell? I said, no. And she said, you need to find another God. And that was a mission, you know. I don't know if it would have been easier to start clean slated or to turn around and to re-understand everything that I know about God. That was hard. We worked a lot on that. Step two, step three. Step three is the step that I have a love-hate relationship with. It is the step that works so quickly for me when I do it. And I love control. My husband makes fun of me because I bitch about, you know, he and the kids not helping me with the laundry or loading a dishwasher, but I don't want them, you know, folding the laundry or loading the dishwasher because they don't do it the way that I do. You know, and I like to have my control and do things the way that I want them done. And that's one of my biggest downfalls. One of my biggest character defects is that control that I love to have so much that kills me slowly on a daily basis. You know, I for the first 2 years, I did. They told me to do a 90 and 90, and Jackie said, you're going to do 2 years and 2 years is what you're going to do. And I said, okay. And I went to a meeting every night because I didn't know what else to do with myself, you know. My mother took care of my daughter willingly, you know, willingly took care of my daughter. I came home every night. She was in bed. I gave her a kiss and told her I loved her. I don't know if she heard me or not. I think she did. And, you know, I my boss started saying to me, what's going on with you? You're like showered and you know, you're awake. And that woman has been hugely supportive to me. They helped me get back into college. I did quit my full-time job at 2 years sober and went back to college full-time and figured out I actually have a brain in my head and graduated at the top of my class. And, you know, came out with a degree, and now I'm scraping teeth for a living, and which is what I've always wanted to do, talking about it on a bar stool, you know. And, you know, slowly, those things that I always talked about doing, drinking, beyond my wildest dreams, they told me when I came in here, if I set my mind to it, you know, I could do it. And, you know, they told me I need to get honest, not just with myself, with my higher power, but with somebody else, at least one other person. You know, I was so excited to do that fourth and fifth step. People dreaded fourth and fifth step. I couldn't wait to get rid of that crap. You know, I needed to tell somebody, you know, what was going on with me. It was that cloud, that dark cloud that just followed me. And, you know, I've gone through probably 3 fourth and fifth steps. I did my first one with Jackie, and you know, I guess I had about 3 years sober. And, you know, she hit some rough times, and some things in her life happened that I wouldn't even imagine. And, after 17 years, she ended up picking up a drink. And that was hard. And it's funny because I ran with this group of girls. There were 5 or 6 of us that ran. And, you know, none of them, with the exception of one, are sober today. That was hard. And so I switched my home group. And I found another group of women, a fantastic group of women. Found a new sponsor, only this sponsor was the one that hugged you and kissed you and told you she loved you. I did not want to ask her to be my sponsor for that reason, but that was the point that I was in my sobriety, was I just started to work on my character defects, 6 and 7, and I need to start writing some wrongs with me, you know, some of the things that I needed to fix, to change. You know, they told me if I didn't change, I would die. And I wanted to change. I wanted to be able to hug my mother and my father and my children and tell them that I love them and not cringe when I did it. You know, it took me a good year with this woman, her hugging me and me being like, ah, get off me. And she taught me how to do that, you know. And this program taught me that it was okay to do that. And, you know, she is fortunately still my sponsor today. And, you know, I was just saying to Dave when I got here, I usually come with a caravan of people. And her mother passed last week, and tonight was the funeral. And so all the girls, of course, are looking at me. I said, she needs you right now. You guys hear me talk all the time. You know, you can't get me to shut up. So you go with her, and I will do my thing. And I had the opportunity to spend time with her this weekend, you know, and tomorrow I'll be spending time with her too. And you know, it's just one of the gifts of the program that I am able to accept friendship today. I have real friends, and, you know, I'm able to be a friend, which is huge. You know, something I never got along with women when I was drinking. Are you kidding me? They would pick me up from the bar and throw me out for starting a fight, and they would say, we'll see you tomorrow, Martine. And I would say, okay. And you know, now all I want to be around is my girls, you know. And things are just so different from when I was drinking. You know, after I got out of college, I worked a couple years, and I met a man. Boy meets girl on AA campus. And we got married. And we had another child, another girl, and that's hard. That's hard, too. Another chapter in the life, being married to another alcoholic. We love taking each other's inventory, you know, on a regular basis, silently sometimes. I'm thinking, boy, he really needs a meeting, you know. But We're both very active in the program, which is huge. You know, it's become a family joke that we outnumber the normal people in my family. When we have a birthday party, you know, I've got my sisters and their husbands, and then you've got the crew of alcoholics, you know, that are in the program. I have a meeting at any given time in my own family, you know, which is awesome. I have a relationship with my father today that I couldn't even describe to you. We hated each other for 22 years. I never knew my father because I was what he was. And, you know, today it's funny. We laugh and we have inside jokes. And that used to drive me crazy. He would come over with his friends and they would have pizza before a meeting and they'd be laughing. And I'm like, what are they laughing at? They can't even drink, you know. And inside, I was dying. I was dying inside, and they were laughing, and I was judging them because they didn't drink. Go figure. And, you know, it's and my husband and I, and we have these two kids, and I'm going to say three years ago, three years ago, we had a house in Phoenixville. We lived in a row home right down from the clubhouse. And we had just renovated the home, and the baby was, about a year old, and my older daughter was nine. And the neighbor had a fire and shared it with us. And we lost everything in our home. And do you know that only sucked for like 5 minutes? Because everybody, people that we didn't know in this program, had us clothed, food, every donation you could possibly think of. Uniform, somebody figured out where my kid went to school and got her a uniform. It was 3 weeks after Christmas. They had all of their gifts replaced. Somebody in the program moved out of his house for 2 weeks and let us move into his house. Unbelievable, the people in this program, that some of these people, I don't know their first names, donated, did whatever they needed to do to make sure that we had what we needed to have to function as a family. In the last, 3 years, we have moved 5 times. We lived with my parents for a year and a half, which was a real treat. Highly recommended. You know what? All kidding aside, my parents let us live there. You know, two alcoholics and their two kids. And they let us live there for a year and a half while we built a new house in Limerick. And, you know, they helped take care of our kids. My husband did not work. He was building the house. So, you know, they took care of my kids while we could get out to meetings so he could build the house. And, you know, who does that, you know? I have fantastic parents, you know, one of which is sober and knew that part of the program was to put the hand out there and to help us, you know. And yeah, we're happy to be out and in our own house right now and settling. We did move in August, and it's wonderful, you know. It's for the first time, you know, I say to my husband, I feel like we just got married, because for the first 4 years, it was absolute hell. It was hell in sobriety. And you know what's funny is I'd take it any day of the week over one day drunk. So many things in sobriety I welcome. I welcome that pain. I've lost a lot of people, you know, family members to this disease. I lost 3 family members sober to this disease, and that's just family members. You know, I lost grandfathers. I've lost, you know, all kinds of broken hearts And you know, another big part of my story, which some people know, is Brian and I were talking earlier about having to watch somebody in their addiction that you care about while you're sitting on the other side sober. You know, I know my brother's been up here twice and told his story, and that was a hard thing to watch. That was a hard thing to watch and a hard thing to step away from. You know, I was 4 months sober when he told me he had a problem, and it took him 2 years to land himself in jail, and another 2 years to get himself out. And I know what my father went through, you know. I know what my father went through watching that. I've lost a lot of friends in the program too, you know. people that come in, they get some time, and then they disappear. And it's only a matter of time, you know. And that scares the hell out of me. It scares me. That is what keeps me sober today. That's what keeps me going to meetings. You know, they kept it simple for me. They said, don't drink, go to meetings, work the steps. You find your higher power, say your prayers every morning, every night, do the next right thing. You know, and you'll be okay. And that's all I did, you know, my first couple years. Don't drink, go to meetings, work a step, talk to my sponsor, say my prayers, and just try and be a decent person, because I never tried to be a decent person. You know, I was famous for doing the next wrong thing. And, you know, it's been a hell of a ride. You know, I'll say it again. My sobriety has had much more ups and downs, probably because I've been sober longer than I drank. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I didn't really have much of a life when I was drinking. You know, this program gave me a life, you know, and I have people in my life, and sometimes we lose those people. You know, it's the people that I got sober with are not around. You know, I've had to change groups of friends, you know, and develop new relationships with people. But, you know, the way that things are today for us is unbelievable. I mean, it is hard to sit back and watch that kind of stuff happen. You know, with relapses and whatnot. I did run into my old sponsor about a year ago in Wawa, and I think she was living out of her car. She didn't look good, and I just put my hand out, and I made sure. I always said to my second sponsor, if I ever see her again, I'm going to tell her. You know, I'm going to tell her what she did for me. And at that point, I had just had 10 years sober. And I saw her at the Wawa, and again, no coincidence. God puts people in my life for a reason. And I said to her, I just want to thank you. And she said, for what? And I said, if it weren't for you, I would not be here. And she just kind of nodded, and I gave her my phone number, and I have not heard from her. The one thing that they taught me to do is to always put my hand out to anybody. You know, and I'm not an anonymous person with my program because you never know when somebody's going to need help. You know, I've run into that experience at work. You know, people always say be careful at work. I work in a place where, you know, my boss actually knew that first sponsor and her husband. And when he asked me how I knew her, I told him. And wouldn't you know, I get phone calls from him on a regular basis. My neighbor, my son's friend, my, you know, my uncle, my this, my that. What do we do? You know, and, yeah, sometimes I wish I would keep my mouth shut because my phone rings off the hook. But that's what I was taught to do, was to let you know that I've been where you are. I had a neighbor 2 weeks ago, ambulance, cops, no idea the woman's been hiding a 3-year vodka habit. No idea. I looked at my husband and said, how did we not know? And he said, baffling. I said, that's pretty much it, you know. And I took her to her first meeting last Saturday. And she said to me, you know, it's really great having two people next door that can help me. And I said, well, if you want to get sober, we're great neighbors to have. If you want to drink, we're going to be your worst nightmare. And, you know, I owe everything to this program today. You know, my life, my job, my friends, that self-respect that I through this program have gotten back, my children who... You know, they laugh at me because I spend the weekend watching American Idol and playing the Wii with my kids. You know, that's my life today, and I love every second of it. You know, my daughter's almost 13 years old and going through the 13-year-old struggles. And I can be there. She asks me why I don't drink beer, you know. She was two when I got sober, so hopefully she doesn't remember a whole lot. She wants to know why I don't drink beer, and I very slowly let out a few little things about it was really fun, and then it was really bad, and then it got even worse. And, you know, at some point, our kids, you know, Brian said it earlier, too, they're just alcoholics in little bodies, you know. And I have to make them aware, you know, just like my own father did, you know. He stayed away, but he made us aware, you know, that there were seats waiting for us if we wanted them. You know, two out of five of us grabbed those seats. There's probably a couple more that need to be in here, but that's none of my business. It's been wonderful, and I have to say, before I close up, and I will end with this, I took the day off today because Dave and I played phone tag for like 6 months, right, on trying to get me up here, and I finally said, you know what, I'm going to take a day off, and I'm going to make it a point to come up there, and I am, again, control freak, and the house always has to be extremely clean and spotless and laundry and blah, blah, blah. And I took, like, 2 hours today, and I laid on the couch. And I felt – I'm really trying to not feel guilty about that. But it's funny because I don't ever do that. I should probably do it more. I'd be a lot more sane. And I you know, I'm flipping through the channels, and The View was on. And I hate The View. I'm not even home during the day to watch TV. And Todd Bridges, Willis, was on. Anybody see that? The last thing that he said, somebody said to him, so are you saying that Alcoholics Anonymous really works? And he said, if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be sitting here. And I went right on Willis, you know. That's how I feel about this program today. My father tells me every day, young lady, you've come a long way, but you have a hell of a long way to go. I certainly do. So I want to thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I hope I helped somebody tonight. That's why I'm here. Thank you.